Hello, everyone. Welcome, everyone, to the Tom French session on sequencing. The room is jammed. I'm sorry, there are no more chairs. If somebody has an empty chair next to him or her, please raise a hand. So if your knees or your back or something can't take sitting on the floor, there's two seats right up front. Okay, that one got filled. There's one back over there. And other than that, I'm sorry, but this is a all the seats are filled, standing room only. First off, welcome to the Nieman Conference. It's a great great crowd here this year. We're happy to have all of you. I'm Mary Newsome. I'm a fellow with the Nieman Foundation this year. If you haven't heard of the Nieman Fellowships for Journalism, I suggest you find out about them because they're fabulous. When I'm back in the real world, I'm an associate editor at the Charlotte Observer in Charlotte, North Carolina, which means I'm an editorial writer and an op-ed columnist. We're here to hear from Tom French today. I am not going to read what's in your conference brochure. You may read that yourself. But I did a little bit of research on Tom. It's incredible what you can find out online about someone. You know, prostitution rings did not come up, just to make that clear. Tom grew up in Indiana and went to IU, and then he went to work at the St. Pete Times in Florida, where he has been ever since, which makes him, I guess, a St. Pete lifer. He also, what I picked up on was an interesting little thread running through these disparate pieces online, and that thread was Bruce Springsteen. You saw Springsteen first in February 26, 1977, a little piece you wrote about, and you quoted from the music he played. You met Roy Peter Clark, supposedly, according to Roy.
That's true.
You met Roy Peter Clark at a Springsteen concert in St. Pete in 1981.
Lakeland.
Pardon?
Lakeland.
In Lakeland. Oh, that's where I lived when I was a kid. Amazing place. Okay. And Roy says that he compares Tom to Springsteen, says they both are balladeers of American life. And I take it you've been following Bruce around the country and the world for many years now. And I guess you would be, what is the term? Is there a term? A springhead or something? No?
Just a fan.
Just a fan. More pertinent to this session, Tom is one of the journalists who really pioneered the use of long-form narrative in U.S. newspapers in the 1980s. In 1998, he won a Pulitzer Prize for a piece he wrote in 97. Actually, it was seven pieces, a seven-installment serial. Each installment, I believe, had a special section called Angels and Demons. It was essentially a crime piece and a police procedural written through the eyes of the victims and the victim's family and the police who solved it. It's a beautiful piece of work, and I recommend everyone take a look at it if you can. Today, Tom is going to talk about how you take a narrative like that and put it in sequence so that it comes out on the paper, comes out in the paper or in whatever form you're publishing it in a way that makes sense to your readers and to the story you're trying to tell. We will have a 20-minute question and answer session at the end of Tom's talk. The session is being recorded. I will remind you then, I'm going to remind you now, that you will need to ask your question into the microphone. And if you don't want anything put on tape, don't say it. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Mary.
Thank you, Mary. Good afternoon, everybody. Sorry it's so crowded for you all back, crowded there in the back. I'm really happy to see you all here, because I'm always worried when I give this talk, when people see that the name of it is sequencing, that they're going to not come, because the word to most people sounds really boring. Sequencing. What the hell is sequencing? Why are you talking about sequencing? I have people ask me that a lot. And I'm going to tell you, but I'll tell you before I tell you that it's my favorite talk to give because I'm kind of a nut and a freak about sequencing. It's this thing I love thinking about. I find myself thinking about it a lot, and I've never heard anyone else give a talk on this one subject. So it's kind of fun to talk about something where I feel like we normally don't get to talk about. By the way, I guess we've run out of handouts. They're going to make some more and have some more available shortly out there somewhere. So I'm sorry for those of you who don't have handouts. But I'm not going to talk about everything on here because we don't have time. This is really something that takes, it's like a day-long session. You could actually talk about it for a week if you wanted to really get into it. But I'm going to give a very abbreviated talk about sequencing and just talk about some general principles. But what do I mean by sequencing? Crystal, could you lower the lights just for a second? Thank you. I was getting ready to give a talk on sequencing at Goucher College, where I teach in the nonfiction program. Woo, sorry. This is going to get interesting. And I got this email from my son, just by coincidence, who was 10 at the time. Dad, and this is exactly how I wrote the email, every thing of it. Dad, I forgot to tell you that Zach and maybe Christian are sleeping over on Friday. On Wednesday, we're going to Islands of Adventure with Mary Kat, and I might have a black eye for the start of school. Nat plus hockey stick plus momentum plus my eye plus ow. Don't ask. Email me. Honk, honk. Ah, that must be the limo. And I looked at this email, and I realized, okay, tucked in the middle is this child has a black eye. Because I was up at Goucher teaching for a couple weeks, so he sent me this email. And he has, and I looked at it, and I realized he had sequenced the story of his black eye into 7 words. And Nat is his big brother. And it's not ice hockey, they're rollerblades in the Florida heat. And he has sequenced the story of his black eye. Nat, this is exactly how he wrote it. Nat plus hockey stick plus momentum plus my eye plus ow. Okay, we can lift the lights back up. Thanks, Crystal. That is as clear an example of sequencing as I can give. Sequencing is how we order the elements of any story. Actually, anything we write, there is an order. Or any kind of, actually, all forms of storytelling, from films and TV documentary to radio, paintings, there's sequencing in all of them. And the principles are essentially the same in all forms of storytelling. And in journalism, they do affect very long stories like Angels and Demons. But they also affect if you are writing a 10-inch quick story. There's sequencing in that story. And the principles of sequencing affect not just, it's really interesting, it's almost like story mechanics at the level of subatomic physics. The same principles apply to the whole story, to each section of your story, to each paragraph, and to each sentence. Because each of those is a sequence within a sequence. So if you want to understand what sequencing is, the best way to do it is to turn on Comedy Central and to watch people telling jokes. Because jokes are a form of storytelling, the form of storytelling that is the most reliant on precise sequencing. Because we've all seen people who can't tell a joke well. And it's almost always a sequencing problem. They get to the end and like, oh, I forgot to tell you, he's from Arkansas. Ah! You know, they haven't sequenced the elements and established the elements of the story in the right order so that the punchline makes sense. That's what sequencing is. And everything we write has a sequence to it. Every story we tell. Stereo instructions, they're god-awful, but they have a sequence to them. And that sequence starts on the first page and then proceeds through the end. They're very poorly sequenced, but they're there. And your story is sequenced. Anything you write, any story you tell, is sequenced whether you think about it or not. And if you're not thinking about it, it's usually not sequenced very well. Which is why I want to just talk about some general principles about some ways to think about sequencing. Any questions so far? I do have, I'm going to go through some of these principles. And I'm going to go through them quickly. I'm not going to talk about everything on this handout because you can sort of read what I mean by each one. I wrote it deliberately so we could sort of move quickly. But what I want to say is that this is applicable to books and magazine articles and very long serial narratives, but it's also applicable to deadline stories. And in fact, what I give is one example of a deadline story I did in 2 days about a nurse and a stillborn baby, and I show some sequencing issues as they applied in that quick story. And I'm happy to talk about the longer work, the long form work, but I know that most people don't get that much time or that kind of space, and that most people are working much more quickly. So I really try to keep it as relevant to your experience as possible. Okay, let's just look at this first one. Study the natural sequence first. In anything you write about, whether it's a school board meeting, you know, or the history of this election, a season of the Red Sox, whatever, in anything there is a natural sequence. And it is worth studying that natural sequence first and understanding it, because that's how things really unfolded. We are nonfiction writers, right? We're all journalists, or we're nonfiction writers. So we are describing things that are true. And if you want to stay as close to the truth of how things unfold as possible, that sequence has a special importance to you, because that is how it really unfolded in real life. Okay, this is actually a good moment for you guys to do that, because I'm going to, can we lower the lights again? Because what I want to show you is one natural sequence. A lot of times writers or storytellers, especially when they're starting out, think that to make a story more interesting, they have to mess with the natural sequence a lot. And the natural sequence is beautiful. And I want to show you a series of paintings that sort of illustrate this. Crystal, if we could go ahead and lower the lights again. Okay, so this is from, we won't keep the lights out long. I don't know if that's good or bad. But this is, Monet painted a series of paintings in the early 1890s of one cathedral in France. And he painted all of them from the same vantage point, looking across the square at the westward facing face of the cathedral. I'm going to go through these while we've got sound. And he did them at different times a day. And you can't all see this probably, but this is 7 to 8 a.m., 8 to 8:30, 9 to 10. The sun is coming up on the other side of the cathedral, noon. Now, this is, by our standards, by journalistic standards, the face of a building is a very low interest item. It doesn't even meet our radar for our neighborhood news, like, what does the sun look like on the cathedral? We're not normally going to write about that. So this is a smaller thing than what we would normally do, even in a community newspaper. And yet these are things he painted 116 years ago, and people still want to see them from around the world. So he was doing something right. And when you look at these, what you see is that there's just incredible complexity, incredible beauty, and incredible variety in just this one subject, following the sun across this stone cathedral through the course of a day, 1 to 2 p.m., 2 to 3 p.m., same angle. He started out painting from an empty apartment across the square, and then the apartment owner rented it out to somebody else and kicked him out. So he moved like a door or so down in the square to a women's clothing and lingerie store that was next door. And the best vantage point was in the dressing room. And the women were not real happy about having this, you know, French artist, you know, this artist sitting there in the dressing room while they're trying to try on clothes and so forth. So he bribed the store's owner and basically paid him some money, and they built a screen around him so that the women couldn't see him and he couldn't see the women. But talk about sequencing. He's looking out the window toward the face of God, and behind him are all these half-naked women. It's just, you know, you got the whole thing there. Okay. So now the sun is coming down onto this side because it faces the west. This, to my mind, is nonfiction reporting. This is describing a very simple fact, not a timely fact, but a timeless fact of what it is like to be alive on this planet and have the sun moving across the sky every day. 6 p.m. Okay, we can turn the lights back up. So study the natural sequence first. Whatever story you're working on, whether it's a narrative or not, and I don't think that every story should be turned into a narrative, it's helpful thinking about what you're trying to do in the simplest, clearest terms possible. What are you trying to describe? What issue are you trying to explore? Who are you following? What's going on? But there needs to be a clear and simple line defined by action, character, or theme. And again, a lot of writers think, or a lot of storytellers think, that to make it more interesting, we have to make that line more complicated. In reality, it's the opposite. We need a line that's clear and simple so that we can explore the complexity along that line. Does that make sense? Because if the reader or your viewer or your listener is having trouble keeping track of where we are, are we in the church? Are we back in the farm? Or who's talking again? If they're getting confused, then they're not thinking about what you want them to be thinking about, which are the issues of the story, right? So I just give a few examples here. These are all true examples. Follow the stripper headed for the city council to protest a ban on lap dancing. That's a clear and simple line of action, a hilarious line of action. But it was very fun. Follow the old woman fighting to save her grandson's life in the apocalyptic aftermath of the hurricane. These are both daily stories, by the way, both by Ann Hull. Follow the gravedigger opening a hole in the ground at Arlington to bury an assassinated president. It's from a Jimmy Breslin column back in 63. Okay? So once you've found that line, next thing is you want to loop away from that line only with discipline and brutality. A mistake that we make as journalists a lot is that we loop way too far away from the line of action because we think the reader needs to know this much. And I guarantee you, if you've been listening to, you listen to stories or watch them or read them, and there's a lot of times when you're thinking at a certain point in those background sections, you start to zone out because I don't really need to know that much. The writer or the journalist has not boiled it down for me. And we tend to loop without much discipline. Does it make sense what I'm talking about when I say looping? Beware the extended flashback, the ornate flash forward. Flash forwards are particularly hard. The so-called expert dragged forward to explain. Zoom in. Think of your whole sequence of whatever it is you're writing. Let's say you're following your subject through 1 hour of his or her day. Even if you're only covering an hour is a lot. If you're writing for a newspaper and you try to describe an hour of someone's actions, that can easily be a 200-inch story. Very often, you want to zoom in not just on one person and not just on 1 hour of one day, but one moment within that day, especially if you're writing quickly and you don't have much space. If you only have 15, 25 inches, maybe not even that much, you want to zoom in extra tight. Does that make sense? So find the part of the sequence that has the most power and the most resonance and that illustrates whatever it is you're trying to illustrate with the most vividness. Map it out, especially on deadline. I use the term map because if I use the word outline, people get afraid. People hate outlines. Writers hate outlines. So people get all freaked out because they remember their third grade teacher, you know, Roman numeral 1, capital A, small 1, small a. That's not what I mean. A lot of times an outline is you just think about what is my beginning, what is my middle, and what is my ending. And you decide, I can't move away from here. I'll show it, then I'll move back. And you decide that plate is your beginning, the pitcher is the middle, and the glass is the ending. And maybe you decide, if you think about it for 5 minutes, I want to end on the pitcher. I want to end on that detail. It's as simple as, it doesn't have to be a complex outline. It's just thinking through what you hope to do and thinking about it as simply and as clearly as possible. Usually this thought occurs as you're driving back to the office, getting ready to put the story together, okay? You're gonna see, if you look through the rest of this handout, I show an outline that I did on deadline, which is a lot more elaborate than that. But I made it more elaborate. This is about the nurse and the stillborn baby, because I had very little time. And in a way, the outline, as you'll see if you look at it later, the outline is my first draft of the story. It's really pretty much, I'm seeing through the story and how I'm going to write it. And I sent it to my editor, because if there's a problem, if the beginning doesn't work, or the ending doesn't work, or there's something else going on that's not going to be, that's going to be problematic, I want him to tell me right away. And so my editor, who was in another office, I sent him this outline. He read it. He said, he's from New Zealand. I can't do a New Zealand accent, but I'll try. He says, well, Squire, he says, just slap a few verbs in there and you're done. Okay. But he liked it. He basically thought we're on the right track. So you'll see an outline. But it's a very elaborate outline, precisely because I didn't have that much time. Open strong, build to better. I love this one. In every other form of storytelling other than journalism, this is understood. In journalism, for various reasons, most of them have to do with the news function of what we do, we've come to believe that you open with the best thing you have, the most amazing thing, the most newsworthy thing, the most vivid thing, and then you get it less interesting from there. In reality, the stories and the pieces that work the best are those that start very strong, draw the reader in, draw the viewer in or the audience in, and then get better from there. That's what we're after. Or they deepen from there. They don't have to have, you don't have to have a bigger explosion at the end, but there needs to be something that deepens. Some insight is gained. Something increases. Our understanding, the drama, the suspense, the sense of love, whatever it is, something gets better. This is true, again, in all forms, in all elements of your story, all units of your story, in every sentence, in every scene, every paragraph, not just the whole story. Which is why if you go to hear Roy Clark's talk tomorrow, Roy's going to talk about the importance of what you place at the end of every paragraph, because there's special power there. So go through your story and listen or look at what is the closing image, the last word, the last detail of every paragraph. And look, is there something else in that paragraph that you can move to the end without changing anything, but just giving more emphasis to that really powerful thing? That will increase the energy level of your stories, that one tip alone, by about 30%. This is why I use this example here. This is why, this principle isn't just about storytelling. It's all, any attempt of a narrative to get across a point of view, especially competing points of view. And as I say here, this is why on American Idol, they have Randy, is it Jackson? I don't know. Randy goes first, Paula's in the middle, and Simon has to go last. Because Randy is the second most interesting judge, right? He has the second most interesting things to say usually. Paula's just nice, and she's, I mean, you want to see how ditzy she, you know, if she looks like she's crazy today or not. But usually what she says is very sweet and very thoughtful and very boring. Okay? Randy is actually, he's more interesting usually than because he's more sharp than what Paula says. But Simon comes in, and oh my God, he's either going to eviscerate the person or he's going to say something brilliant or both. So that's why Simon has to go third. Let's just talk for a second about controlling the traffic. This is really important. There's different kinds of sequencing. How do I say this? Your audience processes the information in your story differently for different forms of storytelling. In visual storytelling, there is a frame usually, a square or a rectangle of information, and our eye takes it in and absorbs that information, and then the frame usually moves forward, or else in photography or painting it doesn't. But your eye has to absorb it. In the written word, the information is presented along a line. And the line starts with the first letter of the first sentence and goes to the last letter of the last sentence. And that line goes through your reader's brain like a ticker tape, like a strand of RNA or DNA or whatever it is. And the reader's brain has to read it and absorb it and take those words and imagine the things that those words represent and process it into images and scenes. That's hard, which is why you have to think very carefully about the order and the way you bring up information on that line. And one of those ways you do it is you control the traffic. Do not flood the reader with too many names, especially at once. If there's one, think about what, who are the people that the reader needs to remember who they are. It's a very good test, by the way, of your stories to see how well you sequenced it. If the, you know, watch somebody in a coffee shop reading one of your stories, wait till 30 seconds after they put it down, and then ask them if they can remember a single name in that story. Usually the answer is going to be no. And that's humbling. And usually that means we haven't thought through who we want the reader to remember. And we haven't cleared out some space around that name and that person and that character. So you need to control that traffic. Control those details. Think about the, really put yourself in the reader's place who doesn't know any of the stuff that you know and is trying to absorb it and process it and imagine it. Shifting between opposites, that's pretty self-explanatory. The classic example I list is Stairway to Heaven. It works. Led Zeppelin did know what they were doing. There's power there. I kind of talked about identifying what you want the reader to remember. And then learn how to crescendo. Study endings that work. Watch how other writers, other storytellers do it. Watch how other journalists do it. Listen to how they do it on NPR. Listen to how they do it on This American Life. Watch how they do it on TV. There are ways, there are endings that work in real life. They're there for us. And sometimes they're smaller endings. They're not necessarily everything works out at the end and everything's tied up in a bow. But usually there is some kind of an ending, and you need to be looking for it. Okay. How are we doing on time? Okay. I'm sorry, I'm going quickly, because this is, like I said, this is an abbreviated session. Any questions so far? Is this making sense? Yeah. Okay. Yes, see here, I just said the importance of slowing down and helping the audience absorb, and I just hurried through everything. Bad sequencing. Bad speaker. What I mean is, I'm sorry, the question was, what do I mean by shifting between opposites? All that means is that you shift between any opposite, that's pleasing. You go from a scene that's happy to a scene that's sad. You go from something that's external to something that's internal, where your main subject is acting, is in movement and in action and is doing something, and then a moment later they're staring in the mirror and they're reflecting. You move from a male perspective to a female perspective. You move from a young perspective to an old perspective. You go from a long paragraph to a short, very short paragraph. A long sentence to a short paragraph. From quiet to loud. From something that's inside to something that's outside. Any kind of opposite. And it's pleasing to the reader or to the audience. It gives the story flow. And you know, I give the example of Stairway to Heaven, because that song, one of the reasons that song works, is not the lyrics, okay? The lyrics, I love Led Zeppelin, but the lyrics are terrible, I think, okay? I mean, no disrespect intended to them, because I did all my high school homework to those guys. But, and still love them. But their lyrics are just, they were just reading too much Lord of the Rings. And I like Lord of the Rings, but come on. So it's not the lyrics that make it work. It's this sense of it starts out so quiet and there is building. And then in the, it just ends in this thunderous onslaught, you know, and that is pleasing. That is a sense of movement. So that's a great example of it. Anybody else? Yes.
I'm a radio reporter.
Yes. Her question was, she's a radio reporter, and she wants to know if the rules of how we absorb information are different for auditory information as a... I have to confess, I mean, I can't really give too detailed or authoritative an answer. I can only tell you what I know from listening, is that these principles definitely apply to auditory storytelling. That, for instance, one of the reasons that, you know, some radio stories are so powerful is that they allow silence. There are words There are actualities, you know, whether it's the sound of the stream running over the rocks or the horses whinnying, whatever. There are real sounds, there are words, and those are mixed with silence. And silence is very, very powerful. You know, I'm not a huge sports fan, and one of the reasons I'm not a big sports fan is I just can't stand listening to those guys. I just want them to shut up, just for a second, and not keep telling me. I don't know anything about football. I don't know anything about the various sports they're talking about, and they're telling me things that I already know, because I just watched it happen. And they just don't appreciate silence. Think back to Charles Corral. There was real quiet in those on-the-road sequences, along with beautiful voices. But it's that juxtaposition between those two opposites is very, very powerful in any form of storytelling. Yes?
I think this is related. Is there a way to get silence into print writing?
There absolutely is.
To get a reader to slow down, to appreciate the sensuality of a scene. You know, how do you do that?
Okay. Her question was, how do you achieve silence on the page? Well, there's a lot of ways. And how do you slow down? And then conversely, how do you speed up on the page? The other question is, when do you speed up and slow down? And that's counterintuitive. When you speed up, is actually we think that you want to speed up when it's interesting, because our heart is racing and we want to go. Actually, you want to speed up through the boring stuff. You want to speed up through the background that we need to cover, because you need to understand this, but we're going to do it quickly. And you need to slow down during the good stuff and let the reader or the viewer or the listener absorb it. So the way you do that, among other ways, there's a bunch of ways. You can actually, thank you. You actually can talk about distance covered per sentence, like miles per sentence. And you can look at stories where the writer, either for an auditory experience on the radio or whatever, or for the page, is covering a lot of ground in each sentence. They drove through Mississippi and Alabama, period. But then when they get to the crucial place in the story where they get to Pecos County, Texas, and there's a shootout, then, like, you know, the sheriff leaned out the door. His deputy was driving, because the sheriff knew that, you know, if you're trying to drive and shoot, it ain't like in the movies, you're going to shoot your own damn car. You know, the sheriff aimed carefully. Boom. He hit the back wheel. Boom. He hit the back right wheel. Boom. You're slowing down, and you're giving the details much more slowly. And one of the ways you do that is through an accretion of detail. You can also, there are ways to do it, like literally, like you can say, you know, you can literally say a few seconds passed, or, you know, he closed his eyes. There's so many things you can do to slow it down. And then, of course, one of the key ways to slow it down is to put a period. And even if you want to slow it down even further, you put a paragraph break. Okay? So it can be done. And also, in your reporting, it's helpful to look for moments, these opposites in your reporting. It's helpful to look for the moment when, let's say you're profiling the mayor, and there's a moment when he or she is screaming at their assistant, you know, and then a moment later, you know, they're whispering to their kids on the phone, you know, good night, because their kids are going to sleep and they're not home yet. Those two moments next to each other on the page are going to be good. And if there's, you know, I saw Richard Ben Kramer in a profile of the Baltimore mayor at the time for Esquire do an amazing scene where he just showed the mayor up in his office looking out the window across the city of Baltimore. And it was, and he asked the mayor what he was thinking about. But we go into that moment, and he's looking for those moments where that quiet and that reflection is happening right there. And there's other scenes, as I recall, where that mayor is in fact screaming at people. And that's pleasing and interesting, because very few of us are just one or the other. Yes?
How would you suggest
how much time do we have? The question was, how do you when there's conflict in a story, how do you maintain the level of conflict through the story?
Yeah, I would suggest maintaining the level of conflict, but still
So his question is, how do you maintain the level? Actually, we were going to do this exercise, but I think we're going to run out of time. That's okay. So if you have questions, let's go ahead and have people come on up, and we can, and maybe we'll do the exercise at the end.
Till
4:30. Okay, then we'll do the exercise in a second. The answer has to do with that natural sequence. There are some conflicts that they brew and they continue for thousands of years. There are other conflicts that build quietly and simmer quietly for years and then explode in 15 seconds. So if you are studying the natural sequence of what you're writing about, a lot of times that answer is there. Because if you're describing something where the level of conflict is always high, you know, if you're following a unit in Baghdad, that is going to seep in. It's going to come in naturally. You don't have to manipulate it. It's there in the natural sequence of the events. But if you're describing a battle in Fallujah, as Dexter Filkins did in the New York Times, writing a daily story, and he's describing that tension that never seems to subside. And then there's this moment in his story where he sees a cat saunter out of a burned-out building and just walk out totally unconcerned in the middle of this battle and just sort of walk like cats walk. And one of the people says, one of these Marines says to, I think his captain or his lieutenant, he says, "Can I shoot him?" And the lieutenant says, "Absolutely not." But there's this moment of odd, peace is not the right word, but it's a different note that's being struck in the midst of that tremendous tension. And actually noting that and being ready for that in his reporting helps him get across the larger level of stress and tension, that's because the cat is actually such a welcome relief that even the one person apparently doesn't know how to respond because he wants to shoot the cat. He's ready to shoot anything that moves. So I don't know, I hope I'm answering your question. A lot of times the answer is right there in the natural sequence. You don't have to artificially manipulate it one way or the other.